Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I am Adam Leshinsky, executive editor of Fortune and your moderator for the program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Stanley McChrystal, retired Army general and author of the new book, Leaders, Myth and Reality. General McChrystal has both demonstrated and observed leadership at the highest levels, from his training at West Point to his service as top commander in Afghanistan under President Obama. He has been widely praised for creating a revolution in warfare that fused intelligence and operations and revolutionized the way military agencies interact and operate. General McChrystal graduated from West Point and trained at the Special Forces School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He also completed year-long fellowships at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and at the Council on Foreign Relations. In his new book, General McChrystal digs deep into the legacies of famed leaders to better understand how particular environments determine what type of leader is needed. Please join me in giving a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to General Stanley McChrystal.
Thank you.
Well, I'm done with my work. It's your turn now.
Adam and I have done this before, so I'm a little steeled for the
But this is going to be the best one.
Absolutely.
Why, you've made leadership both your avocation and your vocation since leaving the military. Why write about leadership? Let's start there.
Yeah. First, because I had been so interested in it during my career, read about it and whatnot, and, you know, studied it. When I retired, I was fascinated, but I knew there were things I didn't know. And one of the things that was interesting is I started writing my memoirs, and I described this to a few people in the summer of 2010, and I didn't think memoirs could be hard because, you know, I was there. But as we did the memoirs and we put out a timeline, we did research on things, and I started to describe the things I was a part of and that I got credit or blame for, what I found was in the interview process, there was very little that I didn't remember correctly, but there was almost everything that I didn't understand completely. So what that meant was there's all these other things happening in every encounter, other people doing things, other factors involved that had a bigger agency on the outcome than actually anything I had done. And so while the biography has the spotlight on me as the star, in reality, I wasn't even the star of those events. I was part of those events, which made me start to think more humbly about myself, but also made me start to think about leadership more. And so as a consequence, I said, well, all right, well, what's happening here? Then wrote a second book, Team of Teams, about organizations leading and transforming, partially based on personal experience in Iraq in 2003 to 2008, but partially in all these other organizations when something really magic occurs or it doesn't occur. And what's the interaction that does that? And again, it's collaboration and those things started to come out as dominant. So then was time to write another book. And I had this nagging problem that I didn't understand what leadership is. And you go, now, wait a minute. You've been doing it for 40 some years. Wake up there, bud. But I didn't think it did. And so with two co-authors, we started with this concern, and we went back to first principles. We went back to Plutarch. I'd never read Plutarch, 1,000 pages, the lives of Greeks and Romans. Went back, and he's really the first biographer, went back and read it cover to cover to understand why we think about leadership as we do. And what we learned through this, and as we modeled our book on Plutarch, we learned that leadership isn't what we think it is, and it never has been. And as a consequence, we had this understanding that we've had this flawed understanding of leadership for all our lives and all our lives and all our parents' lives and grandparents' lives, not because we're dumb or evil, but because we've allowed these mythologies to cover the way we do it. And so we started writing this book, and we're going to profile people, and we didn't have a real thesis. We just had this problem.
Stan, hold on for a second. What didn't we understand? What was wrong? What wasn't leadership?
No, that's exactly right. We think of leadership as being centered around the leader. The leader is the CEO, the general, the whoever it is, and they're there, and we put them on a pedestal, and we think that they have certain gifts or traits. We think that they are responsible for success or failure of the organization, and we think that as followers, we're pretty hard-nosed people, that we demand they produce results. And in all three of those myths, we found none are true. Those people who have leadership traits, you know, they stand tall, they're articulate, they're honest, etc., they don't succeed much more than people who don't. And in reality, when we talk about the leaders responsible for everything the organization does or fails to do, what we find is that's not really true either. It is they are a part of, and it varies in every case because leadership's intentionally contextual. It varies in every case, but the reality is they're not. And so when we focus a spotlight on a single person and say, we're going to solve our problems by bringing in this person to do it, that's always misplaced. And data takes you to that conclusion. And then finally, the idea that we demand results from our leaders is not true either. We think we do. We select, we elect, we promote, we follow based upon this belief that we do that. But in fact, we follow serial failures often. And we support people who don't take us where we want to go.
Who's on your mind right now?
But what they do is they fill an emotional need for us. They are meeting a requirement, but it's an interactive emotional need more than it is absolutely objective things that we think we want.
I wasn't only making a cheap joke a moment ago. Do you have an example of a leader that you studied who people shouldn't have been following but did?
Yeah, I mean, the one that jumps out to us is Adolf Hitler. In fact, Adolf Hitler was elected in 1933, and he was largely discounted by business, by the military. The military thought he was a not very good corporal. Business thought he was kind of a clown and whatnot. But then as he comes in, when in 1944, German officers tried to assassinate him, and they failed, the German population was angry, not because they failed, but because they tried. And this is 11 years into him taking Germany into absolute complete destruction. And the day he died in the spring of 1945, he was still popular. If they'd polled at that point, he'd still be popular. Now, that's completely counterintuitive. And you see that constantly.
One of the delightful things about your new book is that you profile two unexpected groups of people. One, people who we might not have thought of as having been leaders. Yeah. And secondly, people that you might not have thought of at all.
Right.
And so I'm going to prompt you to start on one of the latter. In your new book, you write about a woman named Coco Chanel. And no offense, but I don't think of you as being particularly interested in fashion. But here you are writing about her.
Boy, that hurts deeply.
Yeah, I know. I know.
but it's true. No, the reality is we wanted to write about founders. And so the founder that jumped to my mind for my generation, Walt Disney, because he had created something. He was amazing. He was Uncle Walt on TV Sunday night at 7:30. So that was just obvious, although we learned a lot. And then the suggestion was made, well, let's also do Coco Chanel. And my response was, who? I didn't know it was a person. I thought it was just a brand name, like Microsoft, you know, Chanel. And yet when we studied Coco Chanel, what we found was here is an orphan from rural France. She goes, learns how to sew, but she's not gifted or anything. She becomes a nightclub singer. She gets connected with some army officers at local clubs for whom she essentially becomes a courtesan for one of them. And that's, you know what, seizing an opportunity. And at that particular time, it wasn't particularly looked down on. But then he supports her emotionally and financially, and she turns out to be a brilliant person, the first thing she does is she recognizes that times are changing. And women are in these heavy, very constrictive fashions. And yet at the beginning of the 20th century, as we get into the World War I period, that's not practical for people going in the workforce. It's also expensive when materials are in competition. And it's yesterday's news. So what Coco Chanel does is she changes. She offers a simpler kind of fashion, a more functional fashion, one that fits her athletic lifestyle. And then what's even more brilliant, she just doesn't offer it. She becomes it. Hmm. She dresses the clothes. She lives a lifestyle. She very openly advertises her persona and lifestyle. And she says, come be like Coco. Buy these shoes. Use this perfume. And it was incredibly powerful. And then, of course, she turns out to be a very effective businesswoman. She gives up a lot of the financial control of Chanel, but she keeps creative control until the day she dies. She understands at the end of the day, that's what it's about. She could be a pain to work for because she made female models stand like they were human mannequins for hours, and she would chain smoke cigarettes and keep doing fashion while they stood there. But yet she never had trouble getting people work for her because there was an energy. There was a vision. People were willing to give up something if they could be part of something that was special. And we found that in founders. You know, Walt Disney was not a bowl of cherries to work for. but people would come to him because special things were going on.
What do you think your direct subordinates said about working for you? And what would you have done differently knowing if you knew then what you know now as a leader?
I got one of my colleagues here right now. He's worked with me for many years. I think they would have said that I was energetic and that things were happening, but they would have also said that I am often unreasonable. And just when they clear the high bar and they should be going to the winner's circle to get a gold medal, I'm raising the high bar and saying, let's try it again. And so I think they'd say that I was exhausting to work for. Cheryl Ann's just laughing here. Is that fair, Cheryl Ann? Yes.
Yeah. She's nodding her head.
She's asleep.
No, she's not.
Yeah, and so when I look at the books, somebody asked me that genre that I think is most descriptive of me. In its positive and its negative, I think Founders is. But I also think I touch a little bit into Zealots as well.
Zealots.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's a zealot you wrote about that you want to talk about?
Well, we talk about zealots. Zealot is a person who believes so strongly in something that they've got this just burning passion for it. And you say, well, zealots are crazies. But you know, no, we're actually drawn to zealots. If somebody believes and burns with a white hot flame, we look at them and we go, wow, there must be something to it. So we picked two to parallel, and they were very different. If they'd been on this stage, they wouldn't have fit together. The first was Maximilien Robespierre, the French Revolution. And Robespierre was a lawyer from Arras, France, and he was an introvert. He stayed in his apartments almost all the time writing, and he wrote all these speeches, and yet he was a lousy speaker. But most of the speeches were distributed in paper. But what he did was, first he becomes part of the French Revolution in 1789. And then when everybody else is having second thoughts, should we do a constitutional monarchy? We should do this, should we that? He had no doubts. This is what we're doing. This is the direction we're going. And when the Jacobin Club, which he'd been a part of, all sort of wavered, except for a few people, Robespierre refuses to. And as a consequence, as they come back to him, he becomes the person that's always been fanatically focused on the outcome. But yet it seems contradictory because his outcome was a society of virtue as described by Rousseau. But what he became convinced is to get to this virtuous society, we will do whatever it takes, and that means terror. And so in 5 weeks in 1794, they guillotined 900 French citizens in the center of Paris. They had to move the guillotine out of the city because the blood was getting into the water supply. And this was all for virtue. And he burned so white hot with this that it was magnetic. People like moths attracted to a flame. And then, of course, because he burned so hot, he almost couldn't be sustained. And he was killed by the very movement that he had led. the person we paralleled him with had a personal connection to me, or I had a personal connection to him, was a Jordanian named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he was a kind of a rough customer. He was physically strong. He was personally charismatic, kind of brooding personality. Had come out of 5 years in this prison with that. But he was a very good leader. And what he found is his power as a leader came from being more pious, more focused, more committed. When he was in prison, he tried to remove these tattoos he had with bleach. And when that wouldn't work, he had a razor blade smuggled in and he cut a tattoo off. Every other prisoner saw that. And you think about it, when you're around somebody who's more committed than you are, there's this sort of grudging admiration. Wow, I wouldn't have done that. But he will. And so he was able to lead Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Thousands of Iraqis and other people from around the region came to Iraq and fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq when they didn't share his extreme beliefs. But because he was so committed, so focused, they came and they became part of that. And then when he was killed, when we killed him in June of 2006, we had just about, you know, gotten over the hump. And by 2008, we defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But today, he's the godfather of ISIS. ISIS never talks about Osama bin Laden. They talk about Zawahiri.
And it's interesting, you used the expression grudging admiration. Yeah. It sounds like even though he was your enemy, you have more than grudging admiration for these qualities that you admire.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. At the very beginning of my fight against him in early 2004, he beheaded a young American named Nick Berg, and he filmed it. And we captured the video before it was posted online, but they brought it into our headquarters outside of Baghdad where I was, and they put this laptop in front of me. And they said, sir, you got to see this. And I stood there, and they hit play, and there's six guys standing in black outfits and black hoods, and a young American seated in front of them in an orange jumpsuit, and they talk a while. And then the center guy standing behind Nick Berg pulls out a large butcher knife, grabs Berg, pushes him on the side, and saws his head off on a video. And then they post that. I remember watching it, my fists clench. I had to consciously unclench him. And I remember swearing to myself, we're going to kill him. We are going to kill him. And, of course, the command, you know, got the same kind of passion. And we stayed in the fight against him for 2.5 years. And he was really good at what he did. I mean, he killed a bunch of our people. We killed a bunch of his. He killed thousands of innocent Iraqis. But he was just extraordinarily powerful in creating a movement and then creating a civil war in Iraq. And to be honest, well before we killed him, I had started with this idea that he's an inhuman psychopath. We're just going to wipe him out like vermin. And before long, I started saying, now, wait a minute. He's a really effective opponent. He's charismatic. He's committed. He believes in his cause.
And a good leader.
A good leader.
One of the names in your book surprised me, not for his accomplishments, but on the subject of leadership, and that's Albert Einstein.
Yeah. You know, you think about Albert Einstein as a leader, what did he ever lead? And the answer is nothing. He was never in charge of anything. He was never elected, appointed, or anything like that. We pair him with Leonard Bernstein, who only ever led the New York Philharmonic. But Einstein in 1923 was the most famous person in the world. They did a poll, and he's it. And you say, now, wait a minute. Here's a patent clerk who writes in 1905 these five amazing papers, one of which pushes the special theory of relativity and changes physics forever. And really, after doing the general theory of relativity in 1915 and then completing it in 1919, he doesn't really contribute that much to physics directly after that. In fact, he's not the engine of thought after that. But what he is, he's the engine of connecting people. He makes physics connected. He helps make physics connected in Europe and in the world. He brings young physicists in. He writes 30,000 letters encouraging, helping other physicists to do things. He creates this sense that physics is not only possible, but it's approachable. You know, he looks like your uncle. He's got the big mustache and the hair and the rumpled suit. So now you're not frightened about genius. Now genius seems okay. We all know we're not geniuses, but we're not frightened by him as a genius because he has a manner about him that says, come on in, we'll make this believable. He then serves as a leader in a selfless way. You know, there's a lot of stories about him writing a letter to President Roosevelt suggesting that we build the atomic bomb before the Germans do. He did sign the letter. He didn't write it, though. Other physicists wrote it, and they went to Albert Einstein because he had such stature. They said, if you sign it, the president will read it. And so he did. He was later offered the presidency of the new state of Israel. And they were frankly a little worried he'd take it because they had no idea what happened. But he quite honestly says, I don't know how to be president of Israel. But he became a symbol and a leader in a different kind of way, which means you don't have to be elected or appointed or have a rank or badge.
Before we change the subject to other matters, I'm going to do one more from your book, sure. Which is someone I think that everyone in this room would agree absolutely was a leader and would love to know what more you learned about him, and that's Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, now that's actually in the 13 leaders we cover, he is the one that I came away admiring the most. And the problem is I grew up, my family's from the South. My mother was very connected to the civil rights movement, a great believer. So I sort of reflexively believe in it. And of course, I remember when Dr. King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August of 1963 gave the I Have a Dream speech. And so we want to think of Dr. King as a great guy and this incredible, eloquent spokesperson. But the reality is when he got on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial that day, he was the 11th speaker. He'd written a speech until 4 a.m. He got up that afternoon, he started speaking, he spoke for 11 minutes, and then he wasn't connecting with the crowd. Mahalia Jackson, the gospel singer, was standing behind him, and she goes, Martin, tell him about the dream. He shifts from the text and goes to this familiar riff that he had used before, and he went to I Have a Dream, and that's what we remember. He connected with the crowd, 250,000 people on a warm summer afternoon. He connected with the crowd in a way that's now history. But even that's not that impressive to me. Instead, what's impressive to me is in 1955, as a 26-year-old pastor from Atlanta, he goes to Montgomery, Alabama, becomes pastor of a new church, and they decide to try to desegregate public transportation in Montgomery. And it really had been precipitated, one, by they'd been thinking about this for a while, but a seamstress named Rosa Parks had come out of her store right on Main Street there in Montgomery. She'd sat on a bus bench. I sat there this summer. I went and sat on that bench. The bus came, she got on, she sat down. The bus started moving, and then a white patron got on at a later thing and told her to move to the back of the bus to take her seat, which was the regulation, and she refused. So they used her as a symbol, and the Montgomery African-American community started to coalesce around, okay, we're going to try to desegregate by policy public transportation. And they get together to do this, but they're not quite sure how to do it. They're not even quite sure what they want. At first, they just want more black bus drivers and more equitable treatment. They didn't know exactly what the policy should be, but they elected this young 26-year-old pastor to be their leader. And it's sort of not sure why they did that, because he wasn't the natural person. They had civil rights leaders in Montgomery already, established ones, but they asked him to do it. For the next 382 days, the African-American population of Montgomery walked to work, they carpooled to work, they did whatever they could to avoid using the buses, which put pressure on the public transportation fund revenues and also on businesses. And they knew it would. And the thing that was brilliant about it is every citizen, African-American citizen, had to recommit every day. Because if after a week they got tired of it, they could just get on the bus, pay their money, and ride. And the whole thing would have collapsed, but they recommitted every day. And then they met at night in churches, and this young pastor led this for 382 days, and then they won. And you say, okay, we solved problem solved. No, this was one tiny part of segregation laws in the South. Instead, for the next 12 years, Dr. King leads this disparate group of civil rights groups who had big personalities, different approaches to it. Some wanted to be nonviolent, some wanted to be violent. He had to corral this very different group of people, many of whom had been at it for decades, had to go against stiff opposition from the the white-dominated South, with tepid political support at the national level. And he navigated this not with this zealot approach that Robespierre or Sarkawi would have used, but instead with his deft hand. Sometimes he pushed hard, sometimes he retreated. At Selma, he walked across the bridge, and then by prearrangement with the authorities, they said a prayer and turned around, even though his followers were livid against him for it. So it was a level of leadership that was flexible, adaptable, but never wavered from the overall goal. And he did that for 13 total years until he's murdered in 1968. That was masterful. He died before he was age 40, and yet he showed the level of leadership that I almost never have seen around before. And yet we want to think of him because of the righteousness of his cause. He's actually the most effective manager leader that jumps out in the book as well, and I didn't expect that.
I'm going to pull you out of the history books now and give you an opportunity to talk about some of the leaders that you've interacted with. And I'm going to start with the most obvious one, which is President Obama.
Yeah.
Talk about him as a leader, and briefly remind the audience that you have a very personal and complicated perspective on that question.
Sure. In June of 2010, I was commanding in Afghanistan. An article came out in Rolling Stone magazine.
You were the commander of Allied troops in Afghanistan. Yeah. I'm sorry to help you out there. Correct.
Yeah.
Humility is getting in your way of storytelling here, but go ahead.
And I'd been there a year, and it was a high-profile job because Afghanistan was controversial at the point, and I was pushing the bounds of things. And an article came out in Rolling Stone, and when it came out, we thought it was going to be a puff piece, because we're trying to do a lot of media to get support for the war. And it came out at 2 in the morning Afghan time, and the title was Runaway General. And as soon as I saw the title, I said, this is not good.
Not good.
nor was it good, but it portrayed my team as being kind of locker room antics and disloyal or dismissive of Vice President Biden, particularly, and others. And so within 24 hours, I'd flown back to the United States and offered my resignation to President Obama, and he'd accepted it. He was a gentleman to me my entire time working for him, and that day and since, when we've interacted. But that's awkward. I mean, I'd been in the Army 38 years, and boom, he accepted my resignation, and now I'm on the ticker tape of every TV show for the next, until I got a news story about disgraced general, and so that hurt. Dealing with his administration was really interesting because I'd been in Iraq for 5 years, and then I'd come back, and I was in the joint staff during the election and transition. And what had happened was, President Bush's administration left, President Obama's came in, and they wanted to be anything but like the Bush administration. And the thing that jumped out at me is President Obama is a thoughtful, analytical person. He listens. He takes in information. He is willing to sort of withhold his opinion until all of them come out. And from that standpoint, it's really powerful. But I've become convinced we shouldn't elect a president anymore. We should elect a team, because that's what you get. The president has a role, but the reality is the White House and the administration is a team. And when the team comes in, particularly in a new administration, you think of them as this team, and they are not that. They come in. Some people were on the campaign and they've got tight relations, and some have negative relations. Some people are brought in from other places and there's scar tissue, huge egos, differing agendas, all these things. So when you're trying to deal with this administration, you're dealing with this thing that's constantly changing and coming from different directions. I would get calls in Afghanistan, and at first I was concerned, and they'd say, the White House is angry with you. And at first you go, wow. And then I'd start saying, okay, what part? Is it the window, door, roof? If it is President Obama, you have my attention. If it's not, I don't care. And that was the big takeaway from me, that the genius of a great president is to build a team that works. But it's so easy not to And in today's world where we put the spotlight on an individual and they can be brave and strong and charismatic and all like that, but they can have a team. And President Obama's team for the entire time I worked there was challenging. They weren't trying to do bad for America, but they were challenging.
Challenging, I believe, in Washington, D.C. means something like a pain in the rear end.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they were. And I had also dealt with the previous administration, President George W. Bush's, but I had dealt with them primarily in the second term. So I was seeing a team after they'd shaken out a lot of this.
Interesting.
So I was dealing with people who had relationships and all. So
let me ask you about a current member of President Trump's team who you know well, and that's Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. Good friend. We served together in Fallujah. We served together, you know, for a number of years. I've got huge regard for him. And I think he is focused on the Department of Defense with the right kind of mature thinking.
Is the meme in Washington, certainly in the Trump administration, is that the readiness of the United States military is was degraded under President Obama. It's not where it needs to be. Yeah. As Chuck Todd says on Meet the Press, what say you, sir?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you remember President Kennedy was elected on the missile gap. That was one of the big things John F. Kennedy ran on, the missile gap between us and the Russians. And then, of course, he gets in office and he realizes there is no missile gap. But he's elected, so he goes, well, you know, all right. You know, we do that with the defense budget. Every time we use it as a political tool, so we confuse the defense budget with being a measure of patriotism, and it is not. You have to run the defense budget like a business because we don't have unlimited money. Now, we do have huge responsibilities, so our defense budget is going to be big. You know, the fact that it's equal to the next 17 nations in the world combined isn't that's a ridiculous metric. It doesn't matter because we're trying to do things more than other countries. But the reality is, I think the idea that the previous administration always starved it and the new president only comes in and saves people at the last minute isn't accurate.
So if I could paraphrase, readiness in theory could always be better, but you don't lie awake at night worrying about the readiness of the United States military.
No, I mean, it comes up and down, you know, with different things, but I don't. It's always a crisis from the people in the military because they're mistaken or wrong, but because they are fundamentally a conservative organization, not politically.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they never want to fail you. So if you ask the military how much they need, they will say, I need enough to make sure there's no chance I'll fail you. Mm. And that's a lot.
Stan, I'm going to let an audience member ask the next question. What are your comments on Trump's style? Is he actually as off the cuff as he appears?
Yeah, I mean, off the cuff, I don't know, off the rail. yeah, I think he's instinctual. And somebody asked me if he's a good leader, and I don't think good or bad are the right terms, effective or not. In one sense, he's dramatically effective. He can communicate with people in a way that is as good as probably anybody we've seen in our lifetime in terms of being able to push certain themes and being able to connect with people and to carry the conversation. I think just like zealots, and I don't think he's a zealot, but I think just like zealots, you get a certain fatigue with that. And so the answer is, I think that he is doing a play that works for a while, and now he's finding it harder and harder to make that play work. And so as a consequence, I think he runs the risk of needing to find some other way to get the same level of support that he has had.
This past election cycle, the midterm cycle, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, for the first time in your life, you dipped your toe into the political arena. Tell everyone about that.
Yeah, I did. And I did because I think we've got a crisis of leadership in America. And I think the elites have failed America. And I mean, if you're part of, you know, much of the American population, you look and you say the elites in both parties for the last 50 or 60 years haven't done very well by me. And I think it's a fair perception to have, particularly if you're in parts of society where your wages have been stagnant, your opportunities are limited and whatnot. And they think that elites are preaching at them about this or that opportunity or whatever. In reality, they're saying, I'm down here making steel or digging coal or doing things. And it looks different from here. And I think that's fair. At the same time, I think what happened is we've gotten this hysterical level of argument in politics, and we need to get some better. So the first person I ever supported was one election before this, one person, and he was a veteran running for Congress in Massachusetts, and I agreed to support him before I asked him what party he was running for. Because he was a centrist and he's just a reasonable guy, and I did. I actually went up to the Peabody Elks Club and did a event with him, and he won. And he's in Congress now.
And this, he's a Republican or a Democrat?
He's Democrat. A centrist Democrat. Uh-huh. This time I said, well, there's some other people. I went out and campaigned for a 30-something veteran who was running in Ohio as a very centrist guy and a naval officer, Harvard Business School graduate after that.
Hold on, I got it. You supported a naval officer.
Yeah, I can't believe that. That was, you know. We talk about diversity. My belief in diversity's got limits. But I showed just how open-minded I was because I even supported a Navy guy. But I went out, and he did not win. But I thought it was important because I think that if we can't bring things back to the middle, if we can't bring things back to compromise, then the entire Federalist paper concept of our government doesn't work. Our government doesn't work doing boom one side, then boom to the other side every election cycle. There's got to be something that makes us compromise. And so that was my, and I actually endorsed another guy, a Republican in Ohio, just because I'm trying to find people who will stand up and say, I promise to compromise.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Would you ever consider running for office?
I would have told you no before. Now I would tell you my wife will not consider me running for office. I've been married for 41 years, and she said, you know, if you want to make it 42, don't think about it. But I hope none of us says never now. I don't want young people. I don't want old people. I don't want anybody to say, I wouldn't do it because it's too ugly or I'm too busy or I'm too something. It's too important now. If you are the right, if you're a wing nut, stay on the sideline. If you are not, we all have to be willing because we have got to get it back into a sense where it works. And so from either party, or third party, I just think it's that important.
Which office would interest you?
Wow. I want to be on the Supreme Court. You know, and here's, you know, you don't have
there
to be
have
a lawyer.
There have been not, yeah.
You don't have to be a lawyer.
Yeah. It's been a while. But.
And I'm thinking, I like to wear gym clothes, PT clothes, and you could do that under the black robe. And they only work 9 months of the year. Steady work, I think I'd be great.
I'm gonna take that as you not answering the question. Do you want to run for president? All right. I'm gonna try to get to as many of the audience's questions as
Please.
Possible. There's some great ones. When and how should we get out of Afghanistan? And what type of leader is needed for this?
Yeah, that's a great one. You know, I'm not the right person to ask that question to. And you go, why not? You were there so much. I'm so emotionally tied to the Afghan people. They really are great people, and they've come a long way. They've had 30-some years of civil war and chaos, and the society's torn inside out. So the normal leaders in the society aren't the leaders now. It's clever people. It's warlords. It's things like that. And so as a consequence, it's this perverted society. Hmm. But, you know, the young generation has been back in school since 2001. Females in school, young men. There's a generation coming up that isn't the same as the previous generation. I believe, and maybe I'm wrong because I've been wrong on a lot of things, I believe that that offers hope. So my opinion is we should stay partnered with Afghanistan. And I don't think we should put thousands of troops or billions of dollars. I think it should be a light touch. But I don't think we should turn our backs on them like we did in 1990. You know, once the Russians were pushed out, we literally did an about-faced and walked away. And they said, wait a minute, we just lost 1.2 million people fighting the Russians, your Cold War enemy, United States, and now you're going to walk away? And lots of bad things happen. So I believe that just like World War II, you know, we fought Germany at great cost and then stayed there till today. And just like Asia staying, it's not bad for us to have a light touch in places in the world. In fact, I think it's often good.
This next question is one reason why I love doing Commonwealth Club events, for the questions that the audience asks that I wouldn't have thought of. Your current pictures show you much happier than your army pictures. What changed?
You know, it's funny. I was in Afghanistan, and then when I left, about 6 months later, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs and I got together for coffee. And as soon as I walked in the room, he goes, "Holy shit, Stan, you look 10 years younger." I said, "Well, thanks." You know, I loved the time in Afghanistan in the Army, and I loved being part of it. But, you know, it was serious business. And so the day I retired, everybody thought that was a big, well, not everybody. People go to me, aren't you mad about how you left the service? Well, I'm unhappy about the circumstances. But the day I retired, I started this lucky streak. And everything I've touched, the friends who've come forward, the opportunities I've had, created a business with a friend of mine, and it's got 100 people now. Everything, people I know that I didn't know, has been great. I live next door to my son and daughter-in-law and my two granddaughters, 30 feet away. I mean, talk about great life. So, you know, why wouldn't I be happy?
Related question, what is your physical regimen? Do you still sleep only 4 hours a night, eat one meal a day, and run 7 to 8 miles per day?
Yeah. The last two are true. I eat one meal a day, and I either run for at least an hour, which, as I tell people, is not as far as an hour used to be. and I eat one meal a day, but just by habit. You know, it's funny. I could probably commit a capital crime, but if I was interviewed by people, they go, "Do you really eat one meal a day?" So it's a great, you know. The sleeping thing, I slept 4 hours a night in Iraq because that's how much time I had. You know, we were in this, and we fought all night, and then you went to bed right after dawn, and then you had to get up to get moving again. Now I try to sleep more whenever I can.
These two are related questions, so I'm going to read both of them. The percentage of our population that have experienced military service and leadership has dropped significantly in the last several decades. Yeah. How should America best help foster increased national service? And the other question is, can you give an update on the Franklin Project?
Absolutely. First off, if you think back military service, back after the Civil War, one out of every 68 Americans had been wounded. So everybody saw or knew somebody who carried an open scar from the war. Now it's something like one of every 8,000 Americans. So most of us never even meet anybody who's been wounded. So the reality is the distance from the military experience is greater than it's ever been. And an all-volunteer military does that. I'm a strong believer that every young American should do 1 year of paid service to a nation, not necessarily military, but civilian service, healthcare, education. There's needs across society. And here's why. People say, well, we could get all this free labor. There are 4 million young people in every year group, so we could bring them all out and, you know, put them to work picking up trash, and how great would that be? It would be great to see someone picking up trash. but the reality is, what binds our nation together is the concept of citizenship. The United States wasn't divined by God. He didn't say, "This is the United States, and therefore you are an American." It's a covenant between people who formed a nation, and the idea is it's an agreement that says, I will do certain things, responsibilities, and in return I get certain rights or privileges, defense, the ability to do certain things. And what has happened is, in our society for a long time, there was this sense of community because you had to. You had to have volunteer fire departments. You had to defend on the frontier together. You had to raise barns because you couldn't do it any other way. Nowadays, what has happened is only big things like World War II, where we have to come together, do we come together and we get a common experience. Otherwise, our society is more and more atomized because we don't have the need, or at least we don't have the perceived need. So we hang out with people in our zip code, from our religion, with our financial background, in our sector of work, you know, you name it. So we get atomized. And as a consequence, we don't have that common sense of citizenship that's as broad as it once was. We don't think that citizenship is a great big deal, and it's got a sense of responsibility to every other American. I mean, that's the thing. It's not responsibility to the state. The state is every other American. And so I don't think you learn that in civics class. I think you learn that through experience. Mm-hmm. So what we did was, six and a half years ago, I accepted a position as the chairperson of the lead for the Franklin Project of the Aspen Institute to try to make national service a realistic opportunity for every young American. Now, we didn't try to make it mandatory because people in America don't like mandatory anymore. I mean, we could give money out and say it's mandatory, and you, half of you would fight it. But the reality is we want to make it voluntary but expected, but culturally expected. And so the goal is every young person can do a year in any number range of things. Many programs exist, City Year, AmeriCorps, great ones. Expand those. Make it open to everybody. In fact, make it culturally expected for everybody. And be deemed or be considered by all the young people as something that's a good step forward in their career and their life. And I think we can do that. Polling-wise, the demand from young people is huge. They're all about it. The thing that's holding it up is our generation.
But so this question asker wanted to know what's the status. And,
yeah.
and so I would ask, how's it going?
Well, it's going well, but it's not going as well as it should. It's now the Service Year Alliance. We brought multiple groups together. It's not just the Franklin Project. I'm still the chairperson. We got a robust leadership council, and then we've got a fully paid staff, about 40 people. And we're working it hard, and we've got a three-year campaign underway to get national legislation to push this, because part of this is going to need legislation. Part of it's going to need philanthropy. Part of it's going to need educational and business organizations to do their parts, preferential hiring and admissions and things. We didn't get near the progress in the last election we hoped. Our biggest supporter was John McCain, and so he was a great loss. We've got supporters, but we tried to get it into the presidential discussion. We put it into debate lists, you know, questions and all, but it never made the cut.
You know, I believe so much in this concept that, in part, I think because I'm embarrassed that I haven't served my country in any way. Do military people and veterans resent? And I don't. This isn't about me, but people like me, people who have not served, and you have.
You know, it's funny. They don't, because you make the choice to serve. Now, one of the things I always warn veterans is don't start feeling self-righteous. Don't start patting yourself on the back because people say thank you for your service. Don't think you have a monopoly on patriotism or anything else, because you don't. And what we want to get to is to make civilian service the equal.
Yeah.
Two sides of the same coin. Think about it. You stand at the airport, and I'm going to be flying later tonight, and they'll say all active duty military can get on with the first people. What if you said every young person who's currently doing national service, you get on first? A lot of these kids never are going to get that kind of recognition in their life. And they'd go, wow. And what if everybody just gave them a short round of applause when they got on? Think how that affects them and how they think about themselves and us for the rest of lives. That's where I think it has to go.
You plunged into this career consulting businesses on leadership after leaving the military. And I'm going to ask a question and I'm going to read a question. My question is, do a little compare and contrast about the talent that you see in the corporate world versus the talent that you spent 38 years with in the military. And someone in the audience wants to know, what is the number one reason for failed leadership in business?
Yeah. No, first on the comparison, the military gets very average talent, but they get more mileage out of that average talent than the civilian world does, a lot more.
Let me interrupt you, Stan. Are you being humble again? Okay, so what do you mean, average talent?
I'm talking average intelligence, average ambition, average all of these things. I mean, it is not. There are some top tier, but the reality is, it is not rarefied at all.
Is this because there isn't any money to be had?
No, it's just because a lot of people don't think of it. We don't. There are whole parts of America we don't recruit from. You know, there's, you know, the military comes very geographically focused in the Midwest and the South and whatnot, and other parts are very sparsely represented. Mm. Even in the officer corps, we have very few graduates of Ivy League in the military. There was no ROTC for the longest time. Mm. I teach at Yale, and they started ROTC only since I've been there. Mm. And so you don't have the elites in society represented very much. But the military gets amazing mileage out of it because they spend an amazing amount of time to do that. They talk about leadership. They train leadership constantly. Now, to a degree, they have an advantage because if you're not at war, what else are you doing? But the reality is they do get better mileage because leadership is just in the culture. It's not perfect, but it's in it. In the civilian world, leadership tends to be happenstance. You will have some amazing leaders, and I've had the opportunity to be exposed and work alongside some in our clients who are just stunningly good. They could go out tomorrow and be general officers and be as good as any general in the Army. One of them's here, and Keith Clark could walk out tomorrow and be a general. But the problem is it's not endemic. It's happenstance. Those people don't automatically make it to the top. You get just as many to the top who don't. And we've got a lot of systems that cultural things, short-term goals, quarterly reports, things like that, that cause people to do things that are not really long-term for even the good of their organization or themselves. And corporate budgets get cut to make more profit. And so leader development programs in most companies now are literally non-existent. There used to be big things like Crotonville for GE and others, and there's almost nothing like that in existence. The best they'll have is like a little reading club or something. And so as a consequence, we shouldn't be shocked that we're not producing quite as many leaders as we could and should, because leadership is not something that, you know, you just learn by osmosis.
So the number one reason for failed leadership in business is inadequate training and thoughtfulness about
That's
training
right.
leaders.
And we often don't grade them on it.
Right.
You know, we look at a senior leader. We don't say, how good a leader are they? We say, did they make a lot of money? Did they do X or whatever? And sometimes the two are completely unrelated. That one short-term thing can be absolutely contradictory to the long-term good of the organization.
Hmm. I'm reading this because I think it's a darn good question. What do you say about El Chapo?
Oh. I haven't seen it. But, you know, the mere fact that somebody could be that successful for that long, that illegally, it's got to make you wonder. He's got to be pretty damn good at what he does. But in today's world, how can that go so long? And that should make us give pause.
I'm going to read this out loud and then elaborate on it a little bit to help you think about how to address it. How do you assess the U.S. leadership position in the world tomorrow, which I think means today, like going yeah. forward, and where is our place in the world right now?
Yeah, our place in the world should be and must be a role of leadership. And you say, well, why should we have to lead? We've been doing it for years. Well, that's because that's our position. If we don't like it, too bad. What we ought to admit, though, is being the leader of the world may have taken responsibility. We're at war more than most other countries. We pay a higher price in some ways. We get amazing benefits from it. We get disproportionate advantage from being the leader in the world. So to me, that the idea that we're not getting a fair shake is something we don't understand. There's nobody else can do it. There's nobody else that could even do it. And so we are the essential nation in the world, and we have to recognize that if we don't do it, then the best alternative would be groups doing it, alliances doing it. And some of that's very good, but even alliances need leadership. And so, you know, think about a dysfunctional family. Do you want that lead in the world?
So two part follow-up question. The first part is, I tell me if you agree. I think you just said something that you could not or would not have said as a general officer in the Army, because you sort of, you know, directly yeah. contradicted the President of the United States' current yeah. position. First question. So, and secondly, how do you think his communicating of the very things that you just disagreed with affects our military? because he's out there saying we can't shoulder this burden anymore. Yeah. We pay too much and yeah. enough already of all that.
I disagree sharply with him. And I think that the most important thing you ever have in the world is allies and friends. When I was in Afghanistan, we had 46 nations in the coalition. United States was there because we deemed that Afghanistan was important. Every other nation was there because we asked them to. They weren't there because Afghanistan was important to them. They were there because they wanted to keep the relationship with the United States strong. And we needed to understand that. We say, well, Americans were doing most of the dying. The highest per capita casualty rate was Estonia, not the U.S., and they were out there fighting hard and dying, and they didn't have the same equipment and whatnot. So the first thing is your allies really, really matter, and you don't know how much they matter until you need them. And so the idea of not valuing our relationships is an anathema to me and not very smart. And then the other thing is criticizing them. Think about it. If somebody criticizes you, do you become more loyal friend to them? It doesn't work that way. Behind closed doors, you can say whatever you want. And there are certain things we should push for more spending in NATO. But people have pride. They're human beings. Nations have a national consciousness. And if you denigrate them, they don't forget it, nor would we. And so I think that that is not the character that I want our nation to have and not the character I want us to portray to the world.
So I'll reframe my other question, which is how do you, assuming that many people and the top leadership in the military agrees with what you just said, how do they then react in the current environment?
Yeah, they do their job, and they're very professional. One of the great things in the military, we never talked about politics. You never went in a room of generals or colonels talking about politics because it just wasn't considered right.
To actively avoid the topic because it's going to lead somewhere you don't want to go.
That's exactly. You don't even want to know whether somebody's a Democrat or Republican because then you start thinking of it that way. You don't want, well, let's get a Republican general. You know, that's not it. So we didn't. I think they just lower their head and do their job. And I think they try to do it with as much grace as they can. And they know administrations change and tenors change. So, and they don't want to burn long-term bridges with military allies around the world and whatnot.
Shouldn't true leadership as a social value in the 21st century have a moral component and not be measured by the populist metric of how many follow? Don't true leaders need to take people somewhere of value?
Yeah, now this is a great one. I would answer that question, yes. But if I go back to the book and what we studied, if we say a leader is effective or not, don't say good or bad because that's a moral thing. If effective or not, you can be a very effective leader and be a terrible person and reach terrible outcomes. And we need to recognize that. We need to admit that. I believe, and when we use the word true leader there, I'm not even sure I'd use the word true. I'd say the kind of leader that we need and want should take us somewhere of value, should be based on values and ethics that we admire. But we have to recognize that everybody's values are slightly different. Different interpretation from different cultural backgrounds. So it doesn't have to fit into a narrow thing. You don't have to be a Christian leader. You don't have to be a this leader. I think you have to be a leader in a more elastic but still bounded ethical and values-based realm.
I was thinking you were in the military for 38 years. You interacted with military people, senior, junior, middle, et cetera. You mentioned to me earlier that you've been out talking about your book for about a month now straight. Yeah. Talk about what you've learned from talking to a new group of Americans, different people, civilians, than you had interacted with before.
Yeah, there are so many people out there just doing great work. A lot of small firms doing great work, people in certain jobs. The thing that jumps out at me is how much people want to be part of something they're really proud of. They want to work for a firm they're really proud of. They want to be a part of an organization they're really proud of. They want to be able to say I'm an American and feel really good about that. It's not all about money. It's not all about what's in it for me. There is a desire to think that things are fair in society, but there's this yearning to be part of something. And that's very, very interesting because we think of a Me Too generation or a Me Too society now. That's not the vibe I get from people. The vibe I get is everybody would love, If a parade came out there and it was for the right cause or the right value, we all want to go get in that. But the problem is, it has to come and it's got to be something that we truly believe is of value. That's why when big causes come or whatever, people can feel so good about them.
I'm going to push you a little bit on that, and I'm going to try to ask this in a nonpartisan way. But you mentioned we have a president who insults our allies. We have a president who insults fellow Americans and who also insults people of his own party regularly in public. Yeah. And polls show that somewhere around 40% of the people support him, and we see the rallies on television of people supporting him enthusiastically.
Yeah.
This behavior. How does that square with your observations of the people you meet when you go out and talk to Americans?
Yeah, because I don't think the 40% of the people who support him are racist. I don't think that they are stupid. I don't think they're deplorables. I don't think they are losers. I don't think they are any of that stuff. There are some. There are some in every part of the spectrum of the politics.
Sure.
But the reality is, what he appeals to is the idea that, hey, things aren't being done well in the United States. We have gone off the rails. It's not fair. We don't protect our sovereignty with immigration. We don't have a fair this. We regulate things, and you're paying the cost. And he communicates with the part of the society for whom that cost feels very real and tangible. You know, opportunities and whatnot that have been constrained. Now, a lot of that is the effect of globalization, a modern economy, things that he can't do anything about, and we're just going to happen. But if you were a white male of my age and you were lower middle class, your lifetime started in the 1950s when your father did pretty well, came out of World War II, you're moving along. Then a succession of things happened: the civil rights movement, the equal rights movement, immigration, globalization. Every one of those, you feel as though you've been the bill payer for. Now, you were inordinately, unfairly advantaged back when you started because white males in the lower middle class were in the United States. You've been the bill payer for a whole bunch of things which may be arguably very equitable. For the person who's the bill payer, it still feels painful. Now, that doesn't make them racist, ugly, unfair. It makes them human. And so that's the thing that we have to understand. If we go to the Mideast and we see people who get extreme for Islam and they want to attack the West and whatnot, if you put yourself in this position, it's a pretty rational view.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us would have the same view because they think they've been screwed year after year after year by their own autocratic leaders, by the West who takes their oil, by all these things. So I guess what we've got to be empathetic enough is life is not just a rational argument. It's a rational argument if you got enough to eat, you're not getting shot, you know, you're inside a warm, dry place. If you're not any of those things, life's not a rational argument. It's a very visceral, emotional experience. And if anybody here has ever lost your job, if anybody here has ever not had health care for your kid, if anybody here has ever seen jobs shipped overseas, your job being one of them, if anyone has ever sent their son or daughter to fight in the Mideast and lose them, and then find out that nobody from certain zip codes went at all. In the Vietnam War, 150 kids of general officers and admirals were killed in combat. Not a single son or daughter of a member of Congress was killed. Now, does that statistic mean anything? No, unless you lost somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what I think. You know, we talk about being understanding and empathetic. We got to be empathetic to know that if we were in that situation right now, if you were going to walk out of this room today and you didn't know you were going to sleep tonight, you might have a different position on some of these things. And so when I see suicide bombers in the Mideast, when I see people screaming as white supremacists in Charlottesville, I can disagree with them fundamentally. I mean, completely. But I can still look there and go, you know, there but for a few breaks, might have been me.
You know, I don't know if the rest of you feel the same way, but I just want to say thank you for that answer, because it's not necessarily the answer that I expected, and you helped me understand the answer to my own question.
You're kind, Dad.
Way better than I thought. If you could look at that number on the wall and answer the next question in that number of minutes, I want to take you out of the history books and give you a chance to tell everybody, very briefly, I'm sorry, about one last leader who you had a personal connection to that changed, and that's Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. I grew up with Robert E. Lee as my hero. I went to Washington High School. I went to West Point. He did. And he was the perfect military leader, and we created statues and loved him, and I did. And to be honest, I still do. But I don't feel the same way as I did, because as we, after Charlottesville, and I thought more how his depiction was being used by some people to communicate something that I don't agree with, that made me step away. Whether he would agree with it or not doesn't matter. Then as we studied him more and put him in the book, and I really got down to brass tacks, in 1861, he made the decision to betray his oath that he'd made on the plane at West Point to the United States, the same oath I made. And he spent the next 4 years trying to split the United States, the country his role model, George Washington, had helped create. And he did it ultimately, consciously, for the defense of slavery. Now, even when I put it in the context of the 19th century, even when I put it in the context of loyalty to state, I have a problem with that. Now, people say, well, can't you forgive him? It's not my place to forgive him for that. What it's my place to do is understand that he isn't the perfect leader I thought he was. Hmm. What that means is he's human. That means he's three-dimensional. That means he's flawed, just like me. It means that what we have to do is look at our leaders and stop trying to make them caricatures of perfection and start expecting them to be people. And we have to look in the mirror, and we have to decide what we are as leaders, what our responsibility is. It's not up to us for every generation to wait for a leader to come and lead us to water. We have responsibility. We have agency. We have much more than we often admit. And when I think of Robert E. Lee, I think of the reality is we all share responsibility to recognize that the perfect leader has never been born and never will be. Mm.
I am going to have a bit of housekeeping to do before we conclude, but I think everyone in the room will join me in saying that our country needs more leaders like Stanley McChrystal.
Well, you're kind, Adam.
Please.
Thank you.
And with that, I want to thank Stanley McChrystal, retired Army general and author of the new book, Leaders, Myth and Reality. We also thank everyone here in San Francisco, as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I am Adam Leshinsky, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Adam, thank you, my friend.